Our good friends at Johnny O welcome you to this episode. Now, the iconic Johnny O clothing brand logo of the surfer and his longboard first caught my eye several years ago, but it's the signature Johnny O style where West Coast meets East Coast prep that truly changed the game for me, and I've been wearing Johnny O ever since. And now our listeners can use promo code RICHTAKE at checkout for 20% off your first order at johnny-o.com. That's 20% off the regular price at johnny-o.com. Use the promo code RICHTAKE at checkout for 20% off your first order.
Exploring the impact of sports. Welcome to Rich Take on Sports, the sports podcast with life. Having conversations and hearing personal stories from those who have been impacted, built, and inspired by the role of sports in their lives. Here's your host, Richmond Weaver.
We're going to do this!
This is episode 119. Thanks for being an investor by investing your time to listen. One thing that is often missed in team sports is the aspect of serving the collective whole in order to accomplish the goals of the team. And Kelly Gramlich would learn those principles playing basketball in her home state of Texas, where her love of basketball would eventually lead her to Clemson University, as she would become a member of the women's basketball team from 2011 to 2014, and she still holds the record for the most three-point field goals made in a game. After also earning a graduate degree from Clemson, she would venture into radio and TV broadcasting as an on-air talent at 105.5 The Roar, co-hosting the afternoon show Out of Bounds alongside William Quackenbush since 2016. And you'll be able to find her as a color analyst for women's basketball on the new ACC Network, while also co-hosting the Tiger pregame show with Scott Reimer during football season. Here's episode 119 with Kelly Gramlich. Honored to have Kelly Gramlich here joining me. Kelly, this is the first time in the new studio.
This is awesome. This is really, really cool. I am honored to be the first guest in this studio, which
well,
I just found out.
Saving it for you, though.
That's amazing.
Yes.
Did you save these mugs? The mugs make me feel really legit.
These are awesome. Official now, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, the podcast is truly official when I have T-shirts and a mug now.
That's very cool. Got some water in here, so we'll stay hydrated. But that's how you know you've made it.
That's right. Well, I'm trying. And now I know I've officially made it, and I've got you as a guest.
Oh, I don't, if those are your standards, we'll see. But I'm glad to be here.
Well, I can't thank you enough for your time, because I know you talk for a living.
Yes.
On the radio. So have you always been a person that has enjoyed talking?
I think so. Yeah, I would have to say. I mean, I've always been a talker, someone who enjoyed just conversation, things like that. But I was never, I don't know, I wasn't the kid that envisioned themselves on TV or on radio or something like that in that field from an early age. So I'm not really sure how we ended up here, but I definitely always had the personality of wanting to entertain to a certain extent and make jokes and just kind of always have people around, always a social person, if you will. So maybe that was a sign that I didn't really know.
Were you a class clown?
I was not a class clown. I would not describe myself as a class clown. I picked my moments.
You did.
You know, you pick your moments. You get a little lighthearted joke in there every now and then. But I wouldn't say I was a class clown.
So what was life growing up for you in terms of how sports became involved in your life?
You know, sports, I actually just recently spoke to the Clemson Chamber of Commerce, the ladies' lunch in there. And it was about, I was telling my story. So I just did this, which is good because I don't really.
So now you remember
everything.
I don't
tell it all the time, but, you know, I did live it. So there was that. We were such a sports family from the very beginning. So my mom was a great athlete. She played tennis at Duke and she played number one for them. And her later years there, she was just an incredible athlete. So my family was just full of sports from the beginning. My dad always likes to joke. My mom was the athlete. My dad drank beer for Oklahoma. That's his joke. That's what he loves to say.
that's an athletic performance as well.
Oh, yeah. But especially my mom's side of the family, my grandparents, big sports people. I mean, lifelong season ticket holders at the University of Texas. So been going to Texas football games since I was really small, and basketball games and women's basketball games. My dad and my grandfather would take me to those. So I think from an early age, it was never communicated to me that sports were just for my brother. They were for me as well. And my brother and I mean, we had some battles out in the street.
What's
playing
the age
basketball.
Difference?
15 months.
Oh, so you guys are
yeah.
very,
so two
very
years
close.
In school, but I always say there's no way I would have played college basketball without John, because I played with the boys all growing up with John, and then I would play with my age group with the boys, and John would play up. So we'd have a girl and a younger kid, and they'd say, sure, y'all can be on the same team, you know, because it's a girl, and it's an 8-year-old in a 10-year-old league, and we used to do pretty well. So playing with the boys, that was always a part of my childhood growing up, but sports were on our TV at all times. One of my first papers that my mom kept from kindergarten, you know, you just write like a little story, was about Duke losing the 1999 national championship game. So, and I did grow up a Duke fan. That is something, if you listen to our show, you know, but my mom went to Duke, so you can't follow me on that.
Well,
one.
You have to be a Duke fan when mom goes there.
It was destined to happen. Obviously, I bleed orange now, but... Yeah. It's in the blood.
Of course. And obviously, at the time, Duke was very good at basketball.
They were.
And they have been,
yes.
obviously, for a period of time. And
yes.
Now, was basketball your first love, so to speak? Or did you have a first love in terms of sports?
My brother and I always wonder, how did we get into basketball? Because like I said, my mom was a great tennis player. We were very much a tennis family. My aunt also played tennis. She played tennis at North Texas, and my grandpa loved tennis. So they tried to force tennis on me.
Yeah, what happened
and John,
here?
Gosh, I hope if any of your viewers or listeners love tennis, that's great. I could not get into tennis. I don't know what it was. I tried. It was very repetitive. There was not much going on there. We do have some home videos of my mom trying to get me to play some tennis, but that didn't work. Somehow, some way, I picked up a basketball, and my brother John followed right behind, and then we just started playing basketball. But basketball was definitely my first love. For most of my childhood, maybe until high school, basketball was literally what I thought about at all times.
All the time.
I mean, I absolutely loved it. My dad would always say he never had to push my brother and I to go play or to go shoot or any of that. He bought us a ball, and he would keep us stocked with new basketballs. And we just wanted to do it. I just loved it. So we were out there all the time. And thankfully, I had a brother who, I mean, he loved it as much as I did. So we just played all the time.
And do you think there's any aspect of that with your mom pushing you to tennis? And not in a bad way, obviously. Mm-hmm. I mean, she loved tennis and would enjoy having her children play tennis. But do you think that had anything to do with you not gravitating towards tennis? Or is it more of just the sport itself?
It's possible. I should have done my own research on my own life and figure out how on earth we first picked up a basketball, because I need to get some more clarification on this. Maybe it was the Duke part of watching basketball early, because if you're a Duke fan, you know, you're not really watching football, you're watching basketball. So that's what I saw. But they definitely tried to push tennis out there. But I think basketball, the reason why I loved it so much was because it was my own choice, right? I was drawn to it for some reason. It wasn't something that was picked for me. So maybe that was a good thing in the long run. And basketball, too, is one of those sports. I mean, you see it in our country. It's so much easier to play. When you look at the tennises and the golfs and sports like that, it's just tougher for people of any walk of life to get involved. In basketball, you need a hoop and you need a ball.
Oh, it's so easy.
Yes.
And sometimes
so we
you don't
can
even
play
need a hoop.
All the time. Yeah.
You can just go
right.
out and dribble and play.
Oh,
I remember those days
definitely.
Growing up just dribbling up and down mm-hmm. our street.
Oh, yeah.
And I found just so much joy out of mm-hmm. that. And I think there's also the aspect of I never gravitated towards like tennis or anything mm-hmm. of that nature. Now, later in life, I love
sure,
golf.
Sure.
But I think just from the camaraderie aspect
yes.
of basketball as well. And it was the competition amongst other people, but then you had a team of support. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't the one-on-one type of competition.
That's another really good point too, because with tennis, you're kind of by yourself
yes.
out there, unless you're playing doubles, but a lot of that is about singles, and maybe that's part of what drew my brother and I to basketball is tennis. It just seemed like you were all by yourself, and we grew up on this great street. I mean, we had it's a crazy situation. We had 18 to 20 kids on this street that were all near the same age, and so we would just recruit our neighbors to play basketball with us.
Of course.
None of them ended up being basketball players, but thankfully they put up with us. And it's so much easier to recruit your friends to get a game of two-on-two going than say, let's walk down to the park, bring tennis rackets, play tennis, that kind of thing. Basketball just is unique in that way.
That's right. Well, we live in a neighborhood right now where we do have access to tennis courts. Mm-hmm. It's just right down the road in a park. But inherently, my son will have 8 to 10 guys in our driveway.
Right.
Just playing basketball.
Exactly.
And that, because there's the social aspect mm-hmm. of it, you know, from that side. Now, with you and your brother, though, you'd mentioned, I mean, you guys were obviously close and competitive.
Oh, man,
What's some stories? I'm going to hear some knockdown dragouts.
I'm a really competitive person. Anyone that knows me, that's one of the first things they would say about me. And that comes from my brother. And one thing, actually, my boyfriend loves to say this. He says that John, my brother, still lives rent-free in my head. He still does. Because he just mentally.
He's just there.
Oh, man. And we're opposites in a lot of ways. I mean, John is not emotional. He's very mentally tough. He doesn't show. I mean, he's just calm, cool, collected. I'm a little different than that. And so, you know, if I got up on him, we play one-on-one. We used to play. There were a few summers there where we'd wake up on Saturday. This sounds so just like obsessed with basketball. We'd play one-on-one to 100.
Wow.
And, you know, if I got up, I'd be feeling good and maybe feeling a little cocky. And John was just stone cold, right? And then he would get up and, you know, I'm struggling with that. And so that just drove me insane. And all I wanted to do was beat my brother. And we were always about the same size. I was a little taller than him for most of our childhood. But we were similar in that we could play together and it was even. It was a good test. And then, of course, he got a little bigger. He's taller than me. He's more athletic. And it got tougher. But that made me better because it was difficult. But We had some battles. There's one, I'll tell you a story, and this paints my brother in a negative light, but trust me, he's a great guy.
Okay, it's okay, John. We'll forgive you.
We were playing one-on-one. This was right before, actually, I was a freshman in high school, and I went up for a layup, and he it's not like he shoved me, but it was a physical, like he fouled me a little bit. I happened to fall, and I scraped my face on the ground. This just happened how I fell. And the next day, again, I'm a 14-year-old girl going to high school. The next day at school was picture day.
Oh, my goodness.
And it was rough. Yeah, I had to try to cake on some makeup to make that work. But, you know, the battle scars of those
games. That was a true battle scar.
He apologized. He felt bad. I feel like this is reflecting poorly on him. But it was a hard foul. And those happen.
That's right. Have you been able to thank him for what you described, that he pushed you mm-hmm. ultimately to make you a better player and help you become a college basketball player at Clemson?
Yeah, he knows. He knows. I think I've said it publicly in a few things that were written when I was in college, but he knows that. And I think it also goes the other way because my brother was a really good basketball player at St. Edward's, which is a Division II school mm-hmm. in Austin, and is one of the leading scorers there, started for all 4 years. He's now in law school, and he's about to enter his third year. Really proud of him.
Oh,
but,
of course.
You know, not many brothers say I wouldn't have played college basketball without my sister, but he's told me that too. So,
okay, so
it's really cool.
It's worked both ways.
Yeah. Goes both ways.
And how do your parents feel about the competitiveness with you guys?
There were times where I know it wasn't their favorite thing because it would end in fights.
Yes.
It would end in, you know, tears and all these things. And we were just so competitive about everything. And I think a lot of, especially teenage siblings, you know, when you're that close in age, you're sharing a car. That was an issue for us.
There's some fights right there.
Oh, you know, any parent out there, teenagers or any people that have shared a car with their teenage sibling, you know what I'm saying. But, you know, once you get past that part of it, you're just so grateful that you had someone that close in age that was also as athletically inclined and cared so much about what you were doing. And, you know, we've gotten even closer since then, especially now that John, you know, he's in law school and he's becoming an adult, which is crazy. So we, you know, we just went to Colorado for July 4th together with our grandparents and had a great time. So my parents, I think in the moment probably gave them some headaches, but I also think they knew what they were doing and, they were glad that we had each other. They did a good job making us that close in age. It was good.
Well, I've got two boys that are 19 months apart.
Okay, there you go.
Yes,
so you know.
So they're close. And then my middle one to my third one, my daughter. Mm-hmm. So they're 2 years apart. Mm-hmm. So we did the stair stepper.
Yeah.
You know, so I completely understand the situation of how it can be in a household when they're that close, mm-hmm. which I love, though. I like that. My brother was 5 years yeah. younger than me. And so we were always at different stages in our life. Mm-hmm. And so I was never really, I mean, we had our close moments, yeah. but we were not as close as I know, imagine you guys.
I think being in the same stage, because you're really in the same stage throughout your whole life.
Yes.
Whether it's, I guess it's a little different when you're going to college and the other sibling is still in high school, but you just have that person that you know is going through, basically going
through
the same thing as you and with you. And pretty much you're going to be like that your whole life, which I think is really cool. But I'm sure 5 years is good too.
Well,
right?
I don't know.
If you did it that way, it's okay.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I don't think there's one right or wrong right. situation, because obviously people have kids at different ages, mm-hmm. you know, all the time. So making the transition then from just loving the game and playing it to now actually you're focused in on wanting to do it mm-hmm. in college. I mean, was there a defining moment that you said to yourself, I want to be a college basketball player?
You know, I don't know if there was a defining moment, but that was my dream from a very young age. We watched so much college basketball in my house. I mean, I'm a Spurs fan. We like the Spurs. But because of Duke, we watched a lot of Texas. We watched just a lot of college basketball. And specifically around the time I was growing up, you had the WNBA start. Mm-hmm. It's about a 20-year-old league. So I saw that. And then women's basketball was starting to really gain ground with the Tennessees and the UConns. And Texas was really good where I was growing up. Duke was very good. Oklahoma was good. Those schools. So when I saw that on TV, it made me realize that was out there. And that's, I can't remember a time when I didn't want to play college basketball. That was my dream. People say, you know, you want to grow up and become this, this, and this. I wanted to play college basketball, and then we'll see what happens.
Okay, yes. There was no other plan yeah. after, right?
Let's just get to college and play.
That
was all I wanted to do. And so I thought about that. I mean, I was thinking about that when I was like 8 years old.
That early?
Yeah. And I thought, I would have these kind of thoughts where if I don't go shoot today, you know, someone else is. And I want to play college basketball, and I'm eight. That's just how I thought. I don't even know. It was probably irrational at the time. Well, I didn't need to be thinking like that.
But that's what drove you, though.
Yeah.
That, I mean, it obviously shaped you and impacted you and helped you reach a goal. Because it's one thing just to go play college basketball, but it's another to go play Division I
yeah.
ACC basketball. How did you get to Clemson?
Oh, that's a story that I assign to God, because okay. there's really no other way to explain how I ended up in Clemson. But, you know, talking about playing college basketball, I think when I first started getting some letters, so you'll receive letters in the mail, mm-hmm. whether it's just questionnaires and stuff like that, that's when I started really thinking about it. And then getting into high school, and I was getting better, and I was getting more interest from schools, and I was playing on a really good AAU team, actually. And that's how that all happened. I was playing on a team out of San Antonio, coached by Clarissa Davis, who was a former star at University of Texas. And my team, it was my junior year. So anyone out there who knows AAU, your junior year summer, so the summer before your senior year, is a huge summer
year, yes.
For getting offers and stuff like that. So I was playing on more of a local team, but I joined this team for that summer. And that team that I played on had, I believe it was 10 Division I players. We had a girl go to Texas. We had a girl go to LSU, NC State, Western Kentucky. I mean, the list goes on and on. So it was a really good team. And, you know, I came off the bench. I was the shooter. Trust me, I was not the best player on this team. But that's how I got noticed. Because if you're playing on a team with all these big-time players, coaches are going to be in the stands. And so one game we were playing at a Boo Williams tournament in Virginia, which is a big tournament every year. And I went out there and I hit, I think it was seven threes, something like that. And a Clemson coach happened to be in the stands. And at that point, I had some lower offers and I had some interest from a few Power Five schools, but it was more kind of the smaller schools in Texas that were looking at me. University of Texas was not looking at me. But Clemson did. And so I got a call from Coach Yeo at Clemson, who's now the head coach at Ole Miss. And she said, we want to offer you. It was before I'd even met her. It was
wow.
It was crazy. So I knew I had the offer. And I knew what Clemson was, because through Duke, I knew about the
yes,
ACC.
Of course.
Knew about Clemson. pretty sure I had just watched Clemson destroy Duke in Little John in men's basketball in like 09. I remember that vividly. So I knew about, you know, all that, the orange and purple. But then I came out to Clemson. I visited, and I absolutely loved it. I just loved
it. Just immediate?
Yes. It was, and I think, you know, some football recruits will say that, and I'm sure fans are like, really? It was immediate. And I felt like it was where I needed to be. So I committed. That was before my junior year, or before my senior year, excuse me. And then, you know, looking back on that, at the time, as a 17-year-old kid, I had no idea the kind of decision I was making and how that would shape the whole rest of my life. It's crazy.
It's a huge decision.
It's crazy, yes. And it felt like a huge decision, but it really, I couldn't grasp that at 17.
Of course not, no.
And I don't think I was meant to.
That's right.
Because it would have freaked me out, right?
Yes.
But I also don't think I really understood how far away it was from Texas either. But, you know, you're just like, okay, I'll get on a plane. It's fine. But, I mean, it's the best decision I ever made. I still, it definitely is. But I had no idea the magnitude of it at the time.
And at that moment when you get the offer, though, I mean, is it a, and when you commit, I should say, was there a sense of, all right, relief
that
I've made a decision, I'm good, I'm happy with the decision, and so you didn't have to worry through, because I know you had to be seeing other teammates,
yes,
AAU teammates, what they were going through in terms of the whole recruiting process.
When I see, especially like a big football recruit, which we've seen a lot of that with Clemson, when I see all these schools that they've had offers from, they're taking all their visits, I feel for them in a way. I mean, it's great to be wanted and to have all those options, but the recruiting process is really stressful. And it can just feel like it's weighing you down when, look, like I said, you're 17. I mean, you're looking forward to your senior year of high school. You're looking forward to one more basketball season and prom and all these things. And you just kind of want to do that. And then, of course, you want to go to college, but you want to figure out that decision. So once I made that decision, I think it was June or July, I had a great senior year of high school because I was just done.
Yeah,
and
you didn't
I could
have to
enjoy
think about things.
Basketball. I wasn't putting as much pressure on myself numbers-wise. You know, we had our best season wins and losses-wise in high school and got to enjoy time with my teammates. And yeah, so it really did feel like a weight off my shoulders.
Yeah. Now, obviously, this doesn't it's not impacted for basketball because of the season, how long it goes into, you know, January, February, into March. But as you mentioned, being able to enjoy your senior year, how do you view like some of these football players who are leaving high school early to enroll into college? Because I look back at on it as well. I don't know if I could have done that if that was even an option, because I'm a basketball guy as well. But I don't know if I could do that.
I would
Could
not
you?
Have wanted to do that. No, I mean, I don't know. It's different for everybody. And I know in football it's becoming more and more important.
Yeah.
And I get that. But I understand it from a football perspective. And if the player wants to do it, the player should be able to do it.
Oh, I agree. Yeah.
I'm not a huge advocate of it, though. I don't think I would tell my future child to do that, because you only get a senior year in high school once. And the other part of it, too, is you can ask people what it's like to be a student athlete, and you can gather information and you can try to understand what it's like, but you don't get it until you're there. And trust me, I had a great time in college. I made lifelong friends. It was a great time, but I worked my butt off and I had a full-time job. Really?
You did.
And that's what playing a sport is. So if you're committing to a school to have that full-time job and lay your body out there to play a sport, and they're paying for your school, and it's a great trade-off, I think you should be able to enjoy your senior year. And I would advise that to someone who's kind of waffling with the decision.
Yeah, it would be very tough for me to advise somebody to leave early, because I think it's really not that big of a window of time.
No, it isn't. Yeah, and you're giving up that time that you can never, ever get back.
That's right.
Now, maybe if you're Trevor Lawrence or something, you make that decision and you have the NFL in mind, but for your average student athlete, probably not. Yeah.
What was life like in terms of on the AAU circuit? I mean, were you always traveling? All the time?
And that's another thing to just, I'm so grateful to my parents for so many reasons, but the money and time that they put into, because it wasn't just me too, it was my brother. So, I mean, he did the same thing. So it was one weekend my dad was with John and my mom was with me and vice versa. And they sacrificed a lot just of their free time, obviously their money, to support us, and they never made it feel like we were inconveniencing them at all. But we would travel. You'd play basketball season. The only month off that we had once you get into high school was August, because you get into school September, you're in school, of course, but you're practicing. And then you go through the school year, and starting in April, you start playing a lot of AAU tournaments, and they have these open periods, which are where coaches can come watch you. They might have changed those rules now, but those are mainly in April and July. So you're playing AAU April through July. We would generally take August off. We wouldn't play as much basketball. We'd go on family vacation or whatever, but it's an 11-month season.
Yeah. And again, it's a commitment just to go on that. And I know there's a lot of talk about, you know, is the AAU or the travel teams, is it getting too much where it's disrupting families rather than bringing them together? And I think there is some aspect that it is, that it's adding this pressure to families to always try to be at these exposure camps or whatever it might be. And it's just adding stress to families. Now, again, if the parents are willing to commit, that's their decision. So I'm not saying it's right or wrong.
Sure, yeah.
It's just different than it was when we were growing up. And I say we. I'm older than you, so so I've got the age advantage on you there. But it's just, and I know I'm sounding like the old guy.
No, you're exactly right, though.
But there is
it's
something
a huge
to
commitment.
It.
It's a huge commitment. And there's, I think there are some parents out there that maybe push their kids to do that. If you want to play AAU, the kid has to want it.
Correct.
And even for someone like me who loved basketball, there are weekends where I just said to my dad, I'm struggling right now with motivation. I'm a little burned out. It was just the reality of it. And I think it's tough to do that to our kids. And it's the system that you have to do now. Because if you don't play AAU, you're not playing Division I basketball. It's not happening. So I would love to see some tweaks to it. I don't regret any of it. It was great. But it is a big commitment to ask
and it's
14, 15-year-old.
That's right. And it's one thing when you're 16, 17.
Sure.
You
but
know,
younger,
versus
yeah.
8, 9-year-old, that's where it's getting
we played
way too
some
much.
AAU and 8 and 9-year-old stuff, but and not even that young really, probably 12, 13. But that was mainly local tournaments. And those teams, like I said, I joined that big team. Yeah. Towards the end, those were much more casual. You know, if you needed to miss a weekend, you could. I think pushing that on 8 and 9-year-olds.
Oh, it's way too much.
That's tough. That's right.
What was the biggest transition getting to Clemson then?
Oh, so many. So many. I mean, being so far away from my parents and that kind of thing. And then I didn't know anybody. So kind of building those relationships and making friends.
Yeah. So not one person.
No, I didn't know one person. One of my friends from high school did come to Clemson, and she became one of my best friends. I was just in her wedding. She's amazing. But that's the only person I knew, and she wasn't an athlete. So, yeah, I knew one person. So that was probably the toughest part, adjusting to when you're a freshman, especially a student athlete, because most places at Clemson, freshmen have mandatory study hall because they want to make sure you're doing okay.
That's right.
So you are doing something. You have something scheduled for you from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. every day. And that's not an exaggeration. Every day. So that adjustment, I remember I would come home at night and I'd be like, what happened today? I don't even know. It was so fast. But the beauty of that is some of my best friends who I met at Clemson were also athletes. And so you have the other people you're with, your teammates, fellow athletes that you live with, they know what you're going through. So that was a really cool thing. But probably the time management, time commitment, and then just being so far away. Those were big adjustments.
Did you embrace the structure, though? Or are you a person that really likes structure?
I like structure. I embraced it, for sure. And, you know, with me, too, I had study hall initially, but I didn't need it after a while. So that was good.
You're smart.
I guess. I came from a good high school that got me ready for college. And so after a while, once you get that mandatory study hall out of the way, then you have more free time. So you can kind of figure out how you want to spend your time. But I think it's good that freshmen have that because
it is.
You got to learn how to do college.
It's the study habits.
Yeah,
and
it
I mean, you can be smart or you can, you know, not
and
be.
See,
it's all about the study habits.
I'm not one of the smartest. Yeah. I just I study.
Exactly.
And prepare.
Well, so that's the thing. You go to class, you study, and you're going to have a much better chance of success in college. Unfortunately, my son's realizing that after his freshman year.
Everyone has to learn.
He did. He experienced that freshman year. Like, whoa, this is a little bit different.
Yep.
Now, what about on the court in terms of talent level?
Oh, yeah.
I remember... So I tried to walk on at Clemson.
Okay.
Yeah. This was 1989.
Okay.
Okay. Cliff Ellis was the head coach, and we had a really good team at Clemson. We won the ACC regular season title that year. And I'm talking about Eldon Campbell, Dale Davis, you know, Derek Forrest, Ricky Jones. I mean, elite athletes at the time. And that was a humbling experience for me. Realizing that I knew I couldn't actually play at that level, but I wanted to go to a big time school.
Sure.
And so it was really eye opening for me. But from you, was there even an aspect of, oh, wait a second. Okay, now this basketball is different than what I'm used to.
Yeah. So one of the reasons why I really wanted to go to Clemson was the challenge of playing in the ACC. And the ACC, you won't tell me anything else, is the best women's basketball conference in the country, flat out. It was when I played. I would argue it's even better now because you bring in Notre Dame and you bring in Louisville, these programs that are insane. But we also had Maryland in the league at the time, and that was a little bit after the heyday of Maryland when they won that title in 06. But they were really, really good. So not just in practice, but in games. As a freshman, and I think a lot of freshmen have this, highs and lows, right?
Yes.
Highs of playing really well in the non-conference because the talent level's a little lower. Making some shots in the non-conference, having some good games in conference play, but also some games where I literally went 0 for 11. And if I had made maybe two more shots, we would have beaten Florida State on the road. Stuff like that and it just teaches you a lot, and you got to grow up quickly. And in practice, too, I remember in maybe September, October, when you're getting into preseason before the season, the hardest part, I think most student athletes would tell you this, the hardest part of any part of their year is the preseason, because you're doing two-a-days. You're doing conditioning at 6, weights at 12, practice at 4 with class in between. So I remember times in September when I just thought, I'm not going to make it. I'm not going to make it. These two-a-days are too hard. I can't feel my legs. These kinds of things. So that did prepare me. And then once you go through it once, you know what to expect. But the level of athlete in the ACC, that was the toughest thing for me. What I say my claim to fame is I'm probably the least overall athletic person to play Division I basketball, maybe at Clemson, because my vertical was rough. my speed, one of my coaches used to call me Jet, sarcastically, lovingly, but sarcastically. I worked my butt off, but I just, you know, I didn't have those gifts.
You didn't have it.
But I could shoot, and I knew that. And, you know, if you can bring that to the table, then you can play. And that's how I ended up getting on the court throughout my years at Clemson. And shooting is such a mental thing. You know, you can get the repetition and you can get the muscle memory, but the mental part is sometimes the hardest part. And I struggle with that my freshman year.
Okay, so explain that.
So, you know, shooting with the same confidence in your first shot of the game compared to when you're 0 for 5, that is tough. And it's tough for an 18-year-old kid. It's tough for people in the NBA. You know, and one thing my dad would always tell me is if you're making 35% of your shots, especially from beyond the arc, you're doing well. Like that's how difficult it is. You can't expect to make every shot. And I'm so hard on myself. And that was the toughest part for me, was getting down. If I started the game 0 for 4, it was tough for me to bounce back from that, just mentally. And I learned so much from that process. And my junior year, I was so much better with that. My self-talk was better. I had more confidence. And I think that just comes with gaining experience. But the mental part of being a shooter, I don't think your average fan appreciates that, especially when you're someone like me, when you know your job is to shoot and you know you don't bring as much on the defensive end or stuff like that. You just want so badly to do your job for your team, where you can't really make it up in other areas. That's the tough part of being kind of a shooting specialist, if you will.
And you mentioned that you learned a lot through being able to go through that evolution. What do you mean? What did you learn?
Well, I learned to believe in myself, because I would begin to doubt myself. And I learned the only way to believe in yourself is to continue to put in the work. And so that's what I did. Between my freshman and sophomore year, after I played really well to start the year and then struggled a bit mentally in conference play, just missing shots and that kind of thing. Between my, yes, freshman and sophomore year, I made 10,000 shots in 3 months.
10,000?
I made 10,000. I didn't shoot 10,000. I made 10,000. I have the notebook. I can show you. And one of my coaches challenged me to do that, Coach Yo. And I just gained a level of confidence from that. You know, and I think accepting, too, that failure is part of any sport. It's part of life.
That's right.
That's what basketball taught me, too, is, you know, no one's perfect. And Major League Baseball, if you are successful 30% of the time, you're a great player.
You'd be a Hall of Famer.
Yeah. So just accepting that things aren't always going to go perfectly and to not be so hard on myself. I could go on and on about things I learned.
I'm a firm believer that also that you actually grow more through failure.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Rather than some of the positive things that happen. I mean, it's combined, but failure or not reaching a goal is what really can encapsulate your motivation and
definitely
your ability to grow and eventually reach certain goals. So I know you learned a lot through that whole thing. Have you ever tried to calculate then how many shots you actually have taken over your whole life? Somebody asked me that too.
That
and
would
I was
be
like, I don't even know if I could calculate that.
How many shots I've taken?
Yes.
I think it would have to be in the 400 or 500.
I would say easily has to be.
I've never thought about that.
Yeah, I know. And I
took a lot of shots. Yeah.
Somebody asked me that too, and I didn't know how to answer it because I didn't even know how to calculate it. And that's me. I didn't even play college basketball. I can't even imagine somebody like yourself that has played.
I don't know.
Well, we know you made 10,000, so at least you shot 10,000 shots.
And, you know, one that makes me think of this. Like, looking back on my college career, and my dad will tell you this because I call him after every game. I was living and dying with everything that happened with those games and every shot I took and that kind of thing. And looking back on it, I wish I had the perspective of grown up, 26-year-old me, in that it wasn't life or death. Like, it wasn't, The world will go on. You can't take it as seriously. And so that was a huge lesson I learned. And thankfully, going into college, I had that identity in Christ and in my faith, and I tried not to. There are times where people struggle with this, but I didn't put my worth in what I was doing on the court. That wasn't the most important thing, and I've seen athletes struggle with that. But I think that's those lessons, really those two things of not taking it so seriously, because it in the end is just a basketball game, and then my identity is not in if I go 5 for 7 tonight. Those were the most important things in the long run.
So when did you become so grounded that you knew your identity was in Christ? How early was that with your faith?
It was, I think everyone has to discover that for themselves. And
yeah, everybody has their own journey.
Oh, definitely. And I grew up in a family of faith to a certain extent and had great role models, but I didn't come to faith and understanding my own faith until about my senior year of high school. And then I was very new in it in those last couple years of high school, but then grew in it so much coming out to Clemson. And that's why I'm so thankful for coming out here and this journey too, is because it forced me to rely on my faith like never before. Because my mom
because
wasn't
you're a
down
long
the hall.
Way away from home.
Yeah. My grandfather wasn't down the street. And so that was a huge thing. And then on my first day, basically meeting two girls who I still call my best friends who were also in Christ as well, and having that. These are just things that
Well, as you mentioned, it's a God thing.
Yeah, it's just unbelievable. So, again, why this was the best decision I ever made coming out here.
Well, I didn't come into my faith until I was like 37, 38 years old. I'm 48
now. Everyone has
now.
a different journey.
And I look back and I'm like, gosh. So, like, hearing your story, I'm like, man, I wish I would have found my faith, when I was a senior in high school. But, again, I obviously wasn't prepared for it. Mm-hmm. I wasn't ready at the time. And I'm very thankful that, I did eventually go through that whole process because it's changed my life. And it has grounded me. And I do have that aspect as well, is that I always have a foundation to go back on, no matter what type of void or negativity is going on. I have that. And so I know you obviously had to lean on that at times when you didn't have the support locally,
definitely,
as you're going through a lot of things. What was it like, though, now that you're graduating? Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, I just want to be a college basketball player. And
That's then, a great question. It's right? a great bring it full circle.
That's right. So how we got to hearing Kelly on the radio.
That's
what
good...
was the plan after graduation?
So I went to grad school because I graduated in 3 years at Clemson. So I knew at 20, which is when I graduated, I did not want to go out into the real world yet, and I probably didn't belong in the real world yet. So I applied to grad school at Clemson, and I went to a two-year grad program. It was the Communication Technology and Society program. I was a comm major. It's a small program, but it was so great because I worked with a couple great professors there and got to morph it into a sports focus. And initially, I thought I wanted to be a professor. That's where I was thinking. I always loved
professor
school.
Professor Gramlich.
Yeah, I thought I would become a professor. And so I started, I was a graduate assistant with Jimmy Sanderson, who wrote a lot of scholarly stuff and was helping him research and stuff like that. And it was fun. But then one of my dear friends, Jeff Callen, who is now the director of communications at Clemson, he was the SID for women's basketball. When I played, he was our sports information director. He's come a long way. He's moved up. but I was on the treadmill in Fike, and I was just, you know, trying to stay in shape, right? Because I had finished playing basketball. And I thought, I just need to reach out to Jeff. I want to get back into sports. And it just came to me.
It
I need
just
to
hit
reach
you.
Out to Jeff. Yeah.
On the treadmill.
Again, a God thing, I think. And so I texted him, and Jeff being the, Jeff is the perfect person to work at a university because he is always willing to help someone and always willing to help really any kind of student. He said, come in, we'll get you set up with something. So I started just writing some game stories for women's basketball and helping out at games. And so one game, I forget which game it was, but my co-host now, William Quackenbush, was doing the radio for women's basketball. It's his first year. And so I'm talking with Jeff after the game had just ended. And Quack comes walking over, as he does, and he's talking to Jeff. And I had met Quack before, but I didn't know him. And Quack and I just start arguing about the NBA. It just started happening. Jeff like posed a question and Quack and I just start going, right? And it was a lighthearted argument.
Because you're not competitive or anything, right?
No, not at all. And Jeff Callen just goes, you guys should do this on the radio. And Quack says, yeah, come on in for an internship or come sit in on the show and see if you like it. Quack being the gracious person he is. And so I came in, sat in on the show. That's when Dutch Coleman was there at the time. He was a great guy. Dutch moved on. Ricky Patterson was also in there as a producer, and I was still in grad school. So I was just kind of getting experience. And then as I was about to graduate, WCCP, Deb Jones over there said, would you want to become the full-time producer and co-host? And I said, yeah, this was
Why
always
not?
The plan. Of course, I was going to go into radio. So that's how that happened. And then here we are, Quack and I have been doing that show for 3.5 years.
That's amazing.
I cannot believe when I say that. And I've loved it. And it's opened up so many other doors, too. And I just could have never envisioned this. I had no idea this is what I would end up doing, but it felt like this is what it feels like this is what I should be doing. And I just didn't know it.
Oh, and it sounds like it as well. Because
oh,
you sound very, very good. And you're not afraid to share your opinion.
That's true.
Right?
That is true.
Because, again,
that's
I know you're competitive, right? So there's aspect of you're a social person, but you like making sure your opinion's out there. That's
yes.
a good thing, though.
Yes.
Right?
I hope it's not a... You know, I love debate, right?
Yes.
And that's what I hope Quack and I do on our show. And we try is... And we're both very opinionated. That's why I think it works.
It does.
And I don't let him walk over me. He won't let me walk over him. And so I love having two points of view going back and forth. I think that's very compelling. I hope other people do. But especially the male and female aspect, I love that part of our show because just the reality is Quack thinks about things a little differently than I would.
Yes.
And maybe I feel more passionate about certain topics and Quack about other topics. And so I love that part of our show as well.
Do you enjoy radio... sports talk radio aspect more than play-by-play?
So that's tough. I love both. I love doing color work. I love being a color analyst for basketball. I want to take that as far as I can. I've gotten to call a lot of Clemson women's games, a couple of Clemson men's games, which has been awesome and just speaks to the great people at Clemson for giving me that opportunity, Rick Bagby mainly. I love both. I can't pick one. Right now,
yeah.
I love doing sports talk radio. I love calling basketball.
What's
games.
Your prep like?
For a basketball game?
For both. For the basketball game okay. and the radio show.
I'll start with the radio show because I do that every day. So I get into the station around 9, and I do most of my prep in that first, like, 3 hours before the show. I do some other stuff for the station. I do social media and stuff like that. But I have a couple websites that I really trust. I go to ESPN. I go to CBS Sports, 247, The Athletic, and then some other stuff, and kind of figure out the news of the day. But mainly, Kwok and I both do this. He'll just think of something, right? I want to talk about this, or I'll come across a stat. What we do generally in the morning is I shoot him like 6 Twitter DMs. He shoots me 6 Twitter DMs. And then we figure out what we're going to talk about. And sometimes the topics roll over, of course. And then we try to get some good guests and stuff like that. But that's the main prep for the show. And I'm so fortunate, too, because we do a lot of prep, but thankfully, somehow, you know, Kwok and I were paired together, and we do have a good chemistry, and
That's right.
End up going into some random debates that just take us way off topic. So then we just save topics for the next day. But for a basketball game, I start prepping. Let's say if the game's Thursday, I'll generally start prepping probably Monday or Tuesday, reading through both teams' game notes, and then I make my board, which has the roster for one team, roster for the other team, 3 or 4 bullet points about each player on there. And then what I really like to have and what I like to talk about are overall stats, bullet points for each team, because I kind of want a theme or a storyline for each team going in. And then I highlight some of the main stuff I want to talk about on that board. And for teams I don't know much about, if I'm going outside ACC women's basketball or ACC men's basketball, like I did a Wofford men's game, I'll watch the first half of their most recent game for both teams, just to get a feel of how these guys play. Because you can look on a roster and on a stat sheet and think you know what's going on, but I want to see how they play. That's kind of more important to me. And then you get pronunciations in there and stuff like that, which is really important because people get fired up about that. But that's mainly my prep for a basketball game.
Yeah, I would have to say that doing a little bit of radio, it's amazing that you don't realize how many people out in the world have names that are not easy to pronounce.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Because you come across them all the time.
Oh, I'll tell you this. ACC women's basketball, there is a serious international influence, really. Yeah. Syracuse has so many international players. Georgia Tech and Miami, I guess because they're all in pretty big cities, have so many international players. So Syracuse's roster is... it's like you need Hooked on Phonics. I mean, you need something to figure this out. So it is hard. But, you know, you go by the pronunciation guide. You talk to the SID. That's one thing that actually Pete Yannity, who I've done a lot of games with, one thing he's adamant about, and I've started trying to do this, is talking to the coaches before the game. So getting at least 5 or 10 minutes with each coach. And sometimes it's harder, but that's a great way to really find out what's happening with the team. And just sit down and just pick their brain for a couple minutes, if they let you. And most coaches are gracious about doing that.
When you look back in terms of when you were coming up and loving basketball, mm-hmm. who were some of the players you wanted to be though? Both NBA and WNBA.
Yeah, I loved the WNBA as a kid. I don't follow it as much anymore. But I think one of the best reasons why WNBA exists is for a young girl to be able to see that. I had the orange and white ball, you know, like the one they play with. I'd shoot with that all the time. Cheryl Swoops was my all-time favorite. And I loved the Houston Comets. We went to see a game, a Houston Comets game. I think it was near my birthday or on my birthday, and Cheryl Swoops hit a game winner.
Oh,
and
wow.
I was like hooked. So Cheryl Swoops, a lot of the University of Texas players, I followed them closely, and Duke when Gail Gestenkors was there. Mm. Those were some really good teams. On the men's side, I love J.J. Redick.
Obviously, as a Duke fan at the time.
This is such right? a nerd alert here. I would watch J.J. Redick highlights before my Clemson games just to see the ball go in and see him shoot with the utmost confidence all the time. So J.J. Redick is my all-time favorite player to watch. But back in those days, again, some of those Texas teams, you look at T.J. Ford, Kevin Durant.
Oh, I know.
When Durant played that one year in Austin, we went to a lot of those games. We were so lucky to be able to go. My grandpa had season tickets. And I'll never experience something like that where you'd go to a game and you literally did not want anyone else to shoot the ball. That's how electric he was in college. And I think people forget that because it was one year and not every game was on national TV like Zion had this past year. But he was an incredible player, and those were some really good teams. So watching Kevin Durant was really fun.
Oh, he's a magical player.
And I know he's taken just, some flack recently.
Of course he has.
But just basketball-wise,
yes,
that guy is unbelievable.
He's almost unguardable.
He is, yeah.
Because of his size and his shooting ability.
His stroke was so sweet, right? I mean, he's a seven-footer.
I know.
And he is just draining threes from all over the place. And he had the utmost confidence, too. Green light from anywhere. Loved watching him.
Did you have that type of confidence?
For the most part, yeah. Like I said, there are times where you're 0-for-7 and you're thinking, should I really shoot this three? But especially, yeah, I've always had a certain level of confidence. But it also, it's important in basketball, I think, for a coach to instill that in you. And every coach I ever had gave me the greenest of green lights. And so that gives you, I mean, if you're 0-for-8 and they're still screaming at you to shoot and they're saying, Kelly, I'm going to take you out if you don't shoot.
Yeah.
That, you know, that's a good thing to hear.
What about talking trash? If you like JJ Redick,
oh,
were you that type of player as well?
I supported JJ's play. His trash talking and attitude were not great. I was such a wimp when it comes to talking trash. I wish I could tell you I talked trash.
Yes, come on. We want to hear those stories.
I never even got a technical foul ever.
Never.
And I wish I had. I wish I could brag about a technical foul. Oh man. I just went out. My entire philosophy was, you know, my play will speak for itself. I'm not gonna because I
you don't need to
I'm
say
I'm not
anything,
good at talking
right?
trash. I'm not good at it. I know I'm not. You gotta know your strengths.
That's right.
Let my teammates talk trash.
Now, what about just from a perspective as I mean, I know you've talked a little bit about lessons that you've learned mm-hmm. through sports, but how would you sum up, you know, what sports has meant to you? Because as you described a little bit, it's interesting. The irony of sports is what I feel is that, yes, the world continues to go mm-hmm. around, no matter if you win or lose in a game
yeah.
or whatever, but the magnitude or the impact of sports mm-hmm. of what it can do, as we see when teams win, what it does. So from your perspective, just in your life, how would you sum it up?
So I've learned so many things through sports, and they've impacted me so much. I would say in many ways, sports is one of our true meritocracies that we still have, right? If you work hard enough, now there are some people that are just more physically gifted, and that's fine. That's life. But if you put the work in, you can get somewhere. You can play college basketball. You can play at the collegiate level, you can make your varsity team if you're willing to put the work in. That is probably one of the most important things I learned. And then also, and I think this is so important now, especially with basketball, I also learned it's not really about me. When you're on a team and the goal is to win, and even especially in college, in high school, you could say I was the star, but in college I was not, you know? And I had a specific role, and if I didn't do that role, we probably weren't going to be successful. But in the end, it was about the collective and it wasn't all about me and what I wanted and all that stuff. And I think it takes time for kids to learn that. But that's why I think sports are so important, because other people are relying on you, right? If you mess up, if you're late, if you get in trouble, other people pay for that. And I think that's a really important thing. And that's why I would advocate for at least play some level of sport
exactly.
for every kid, especially team sports, because it makes you realize that
it does.
It ain't all about you.
No, it's
and
not.
I think that's important.
And I would agree with you 100%. Not saying they have to be a star.
No, just
get some exposure
so
they can experience what that is like, because ultimately they're going to experience something very similar to mm-hmm. that sporting
yeah.
situation in real life.
Exactly.
That's just the reality
mm-hmm.
of it. What about any words of wisdom? I'm big on
oh.
phrases, mottos, quotes, or just life advice. And I know
words
I've lived life
wisdom.
Longer than you, but you know, I'm always about learning mm-hmm. From other people, just advice that they have or just phrases or quotes that they've leaned on that have helped them.
Oh, man. Words of wisdom. I think, you know, one of the most important things I try to do, and this is not perfect. Of course, this doesn't happen. But it is biblical, and love your neighbor as yourself. That is such an important thing that I try to do. And just to try to, I actually have a screensaver on my phone that Christ did not come to be served, but to serve. You know, that is one of the most important things I think that people can learn. And again, the idea of being on a team, it's not about you. for this team to be successful, you've got to put in something. You've got to serve someone else. You have to serve that greater good, that greater body. So I think those are the two things I try to lean on. Of course, it doesn't always happen. but, you know, I've really tried to just to make relationships a priority. And I don't want anyone to talk to me or have known me in college or know me in high school or whatever and have something bad to say about me. Not saying that it's always sunshine and butterflies and we don't have arguments or disagreements, but I just hope that they know that I value that relationship. I hope I treated them well, you know, and have that mutual kind of respect. But I think it all comes down to people. People are, you know, mainly why we're here, to love each other and to build meaningful relationships. And that's the thing. Those are the things that will last, right? Because when I look back at Clemson, I have my degree, which is very important. have my ring. But the main thing that impacts me every day are those people that I got to know and the friendships and the weddings you get to be in. And that's what's important. So I guess that's my wisdom, my life advice.
I admire that because love is the foundation.
Yeah.
And it's the tough part that you describe, though, that it's hard at times to love the unlovable.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can do that, if you can have that type of mindset, you're going to be in a far better place than the opposite of that.
For sure.
So
there are times when we are also unlovable.
Yes,
and we
exactly.
have to realize that.
Like,
and someone else has
every
loved
day
us.
For me.
They put up with us.
That's right.
Exactly.
Well, I admire that, and I admire everything that you're doing, and it's been an honor having you as a guest, so
is
thank you so much,
over?
Kelly. Yes, it is.
Oh my gosh.
I know. Well, I could actually, I could continue talking for hours.
I think people have probably heard enough. We probably need to flip the mics, Rich.
No.
We need to do that sometime.
Well, I appreciate it. Kelly, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Competition in life is something we all expect, and for many of us, it's that competition and competitive spirit that drives each of us to excel each and every day, just like it continues to drive Kelly. And when you are able to harness that spirit to focus on the collective we, then you just might find fulfillment not only by reaching goals, but by also serving others. Now that finishes episode 119, and unfortunately, technology gremlins did show up unexpected with our conversation with Kelly. The video file was corrupt, and we tried multiple avenues to repair the file without any success. So unfortunately, you can't watch our conversation with Kelly, but you can watch many of our other conversations by visiting our Rich Take on Sports YouTube channel, where you can easily subscribe. And remember, focus forward so we don't live in the past. All the best, everyone.
You've been listening to Rich Take on Sports, the sports podcast with life. Visit richtakeonsports.com to subscribe and catch up on any episodes you might have missed. You can also follow us on Twitter @RichTakeSports. Thanks for listening.